Now I am.
Now I'm recording, you dumb idiot. Now you can talk instead of talk to your fucking self. Welcome back. Oh, I hit the mic. Welcome back to Gumshoe Weekly,
the epicenter of murder, mystery, and terrible crimes I cannot forget.
So dark, so early. I'm your host, Brianna.
I'm your host. That car was loud. And my name is Jennifer Lawrence. Like... Not really.
Don't sue us. We have no money.
My name is Jorance. Lennifer.
Lennifer Jorance.
Lennifer Jorance. And that's me.
Yeah. I mean, the cars, I feel like, only start driving when we're talking on the podcast.
Only when we need to be heard very clearly. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Please. I have a question.
Okay.
What is your favorite part about your job? I have none. I'm dead inside.
I How hate is it this here. Question Get fun, then?
I don't know. I guess to give us a little...
Okay, so mine would be... I like the people I work with.
I feel like that's a good...
I like some of the people I work with. Make an addendum to that.
So if it was like... If you had to move jobs... I guess the question I'm trying to ask is like, what is your favorite part of the job outside of the people you work with? Because it's a job you can kind of take... not anywhere, but like... Career-wise, what's your favorite part of your career? Like, Clarify. Okay, for instance, my favorite part of the job is... So, I work in retail, as you know, because we are friends outside of this room. I work in retail. I think the part that I like the most about my job is... Sometimes it can be really, really rewarding in that you make people's day mm-hmm. with books. You don't know where I work. Yeah, you guys don't know where I work. Don't you ever fucking find me. And the fact that I can have conversation about books and learn new things about books. Mm-hmm. So I think that, to me, is my favorite part of my job. And I get to make things look really pretty, which I'm good at.
Yeah.
So that's something, like, you know, does that make it more clear what I was asking?
Yeah, I don't think I have. I hate my job so much. I don't think you understand. I think I just like...
Like, if you like coffee, do you like trying all the new coffee drinks? I don't like coffee, so I can't relate.
It's fun. It's not anything that, because I'm one of those people where I could go to a coffee place and I'm not going to be like, I'm afraid to try this in case it's bad, so I'm not going to get it.
Mm-hmm. I'm 100% one of those people.
It cripples some people.
It does. They're like, but what I...
They're like, yeah. God, I just really want to try the pistachio, but what if it's bad? And I'm like, if it's bad, I'll make you something else. Free. And they're like, no, I can't risk it. And I'm like, oh my god, how do you live like this?
You're like, I don't like anything. It's fine.
I like it. It's easy. I like how easy it is. I think the only part of my job I enjoy is the people that I work with and nothing else. So mm-hmm. I like to train my team to know things that I find to be satisfying. It makes me happy to know that I'm helping them later on in life because mm-hmm. I think that I'm imparting stuff to them that they can then apply at more jobs. Because mm-hmm. I try to train them for jobs in general and not specifically our job. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's like, if you ever quit or get fired, this is applicable. But it is at every job, including the old job. It's just like, yeah, just like the people I work with. Yeah. And then at the old job, it was like working at a hobby store. So of course you're going to like some stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's a specialty store and not a regular store.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense.
I don't have a good answer. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's your answer.
I hate my job. I hate it so much. I've hated it since I started there.
Yeah.
But okay. I hate it. Okay, so what celebrity would you rate as a perfect 10? Perfect, godly, amazing, incredible. You don't even have to find them attractive, but you're like, they're one of those people that's like perfectly symmetrical.
So we're not putting personality into it.
No, you can. 100%. Whatever you think it takes to be a perfect 10.
A perfect 10? The only two people I can see in my head are Ryan Reynolds. God, he's just such a man.
He is what a man. What a mighty young man? Or is it mighty good man?
Whitey good man.
You said whitey.
He is white.
Whitey good man.
He's funny. He's smart.
Yeah.
He's just like the perfect.
He's funny in a way. Gorgeous. That I feel like almost no one in the world is.
Yeah.
I wouldn't try to have a conversation with him. He would be too witty, and you're like, all right, I gotta get out of here.
And he's also, like, from what it looks like, he's, like, really, really nice, a thoughtful person. Mm-hmm. But then that brings me to...
And I really like his relationship with Blake Lively.
I hate Blake Lively.
Oh. This is unexpected. Did you see A Simple Favor?
No.
That will make you love her.
She looks dead in the eyes to me.
She in that movie is such a bad bitch. Like, legit. There's a part where she's just a fucking power mom in a pantsuit.
Love
and those. she's just fucking cool. She doesn't have time for it. Any of it. Mm-hmm. And Anna Kendrick is her fucking co-star. Mm-hmm. So then Anna Kendrick's trying to be like cool, but she's Anna Kendrick. She plays herself in that fucking movie. She
plays herself in everything she said.
In everything she said, she plays herself. And so she's like, oh, sorry. And Blake Lively literally cuts her off mid-sentence. And she's like, stop apologizing. Why are you apologizing? And it's just like that, where she's like, you don't have to do this if you blah, 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 whatever. Yeah. She's just very, like, intense.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing movie. She's an amazing actress. Anna Kendrick is so good in that movie. I was like, God, I hope she's a little bit more like this character than the other ones she's played.
And then my other one would be Harry Styles. Because he's just the nicest person in the fucking world.
He is very sweet.
He's just so nice.
It's incomparable.
He's so... To me, he's pretty fucking woke. I love that. I love me a woke man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's just breaking social norms, so I love it.
And he's friends with Lizzo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody friends with Lizzo is fucking cool. So, yeah, that would be for men. I don't know who I would pick for
women. Did you know, I saw somebody was just posting. I knew about this happening, but I didn't think about it like this. Because everyone is like, someone just posted about it. I think it was Evan Ross Katz. He's like a fashion blogger. But he was like, Harry Styles. He loves Harry Styles. He's all out for Harry Styles. But he was like, posting, and he was like, let us not forget that Brad Pitt is the one who started to pave the way, because Brad Pitt did those magazine shoots where he was in a very, very feminine frilly dress, mm-hmm. and he was on the cover, and they, like, he had a spread,
yeah,
and everyone hated him for it because he was in dresses, but that was in fucking, like, 2010.
I wasn't looking at those fucking magazines in 2010.
I remember this one specifically, but it's like, it isn't the first time. I'm glad that it's now finally normalized, but, yeah. Well, more normalized. I don't want to say that there aren't bridges to cross, but it's way more acceptable instead of everyone being like, but why do you have a dress on? Mm-hmm. But why?
Yeah.
Because I should be allowed to. But why do you?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's like Brad Pitt, and it was right after, I think it was right after they filmed Fight Club and everything, because he had his, like, shaved head, and he looked fucking deranged. Mm-hmm. It was a good shoot.
He looks like he smells like cat pee.
Brad Pitt?
Yeah.
I don't like his long hair.
He looks disgusting with long hair. He was incredible, like many people
with long hair, so. Yeah. He, incredible? Like, hot?
Yeah.
As an old man, baby?
No. There was an in-between. He was just a regular man at one point.
Didn't catch the flick. Didn't catch the...
Don't. It's like 4 hours long.
No, it didn't look good. Plus, everyone has called me Benjamin Button since I was 16 years old because of my hands. Because of my old man baby hands. They're horrifyingly wrinkly.
Yeah. It was a very good movie, though.
I didn't see it. I do like Brad Pitt's work.
I think he's good in a lot of things. Johnny Depp, definitely up there.
You know... Actually, that reminds me of something. Let's recircle back on Johnny Depp. But let me tell you real quick. In Brad Pitt's movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I really liked that, too.
That was very good.
He had Johnny long hair. Depp, circling back, huh?
He had long hair.
He had long hair, but it wasn't gross. Johnny Depp, can you tell me, can somebody please comment on our Instagram, DM us, email us,
on our Twitter.
What's the current situation with him and Amber Heard? Because I saw a ruling that said that they were like, yeah, Johnny Depp definitely beat her, but Johnny Depp had all this proof that she had been beating him, so...
So last I heard was everything she said was a lie. Mm-hmm. He has recordings and stuff of her hitting herself.
Yeah.
That doesn't take away from the fact that he was totally real hopped up on drugs. Mm-hmm. But that basically he never did any of that.
Okay.
And she was canceled. Yeah. Because then she got kicked out of the Aquaman 2.
She didn't. She was even in the Justice League. She was one of the few actors they pulled to reshoot in the Zack Snyder Justice League. Yeah.
I don't know then. I don't really pay attention
but
to
that much. This is the only thing that turned around, because I didn't realize I followed her on Instagram. Mm. And she made a post in the description.
He definitely lost a lot more stuff than she did, though, for sure.
Yeah. But that's the thing is, like, they didn't start to cut her from movies when he was like, oh, I have proof, too. They had been already dropping him from everything.
Yeah.
Which, as you should, if it's true.
Yeah.
But it seemed a lot like they didn't have proof, like, they hadn't solidified anything on either side, and they just started making decisions in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But this is the court's ruling. This is from her lawyer. She just posted this month. We are pleased, but by no means surprised, by the court's denial of Mr. Depp's application for appeal. Evidence presented in the UK case was overwhelming and undeniable. To reiterate, their original verdict was that Mr. Depp beat Amber on no fewer than 12 occasions and was left in fear of her life. Mr. Depp's confused recollections caused by years of substance abuse meant he was not a credible witness to his own actions. The verdict stands, and British journalists can write without fear of legal threats that Mr. Depp is categorically a wife beater. So, I've been trying to look into it, but I can't get anything fucking solid, so if anybody could just tell me.
That's the thing. If it's her lawyer.
Just shoot me a link.
If it's her lawyer, they're obviously going to push the narrative of her being beat, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? They're not really going to push the other one.
Well, and
so, I don't know. I'm not saying that he did or he didn't. I'm just saying.
But it's if really... the court accepted it, though.
Yeah. But how many people get put in jail all the time and they didn't do anything?
I'm just saying, like, if Johnny Depp comes at you with a lot of proof, I feel like you're going to at least look at it.
Yeah.
So I just want to know where we stand. I want to know who to...
I don't know.
...kind of look at, because... You know, I don't want to discount anybody who has been beaten by their spouse.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
I just want to know. I want you guys to tell me. I know somebody's got a link out there. They can just send me. Well, just in case you're wondering, my perfect 10, which that was Blake Lively reminded me of Amber Heard. That's why I was like, oh, I was like, oh, Amber Heard. And then you brought up Johnny Depp and I was like, oh, Amber Heard again. I don't know why, but I always associate those two together. But anyways... So my perfect 10, and this is going to come as a shock to everyone, is John Bernthal.
I don't know who that is.
Obviously, it's Shane from The Walking Dead.
Oh, God.
And it will always be. And I'm going to tell you, I couldn't even think of a second person. Because he's it. He's it for me. I feel like he's perfect. He's wholesome. He's fucking got a body yaddy yaddy. His fucking... face is, like, the most attractive face I've ever seen in my life. Like, that, for me. You're always like, oh, I like a weird-looking feller.
I like him weird.
That is my weird-looking feller. For sure. If I ever met a man who had, like, even half of the weird facial features he had, when he went insane and shaved his head in Walking Dead, So, I'm just saying, that's my, like, perfect 10. And he's, like, super wholesome, loves his kids, loves his dogs, all of that. Loves his wife. I think he's married. He loves somebody.
He had kids with somebody.
He had kids with someone. But...
I don't know.
Yeah, and he still even, like, will post on his, like, old co-stars, like, photos and stuff. And he's like, hey, love you. Like, that's it's cute. Just cute. I love him. So. And he has, frankly, an amazing voice. And also, I've watched everything he's been in. Everything. Even that one movie, The Accountant, with Ben Affleck, where he plays... Well, I can't give that away. He plays a really hardcore mercenary, though. That's my perfect 10. Were you gonna say something?
No, I just don't agree with that one, but that's totally fine. That is okay. His face looks like beat-up clay
to me. I think his face is incredibly attractive. I wouldn't change anything. I love his humongous broken nose.
That's the thing for me. I'm just like...
I'm like... Oh.
Get that shit fixed. Just like Matthew McConaughey.
I like
not McConaughey, the other one.
I like anybody who looks like they fight.
No. I like my boys pretty.
You got a little bit of blood just like trickling down. Oh, yeah. When he's like in a shirtless scene and everyone's like, oh, his body's like, he's got like those really big muscles and not in like a bodybuilder way. It's like, yeah, he uses those muscles to kill a man with his bare hands. Oh, and that's God. What I find attractive. Brute force.
Nice.
Okay. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Scissors. I forgot paper. To throw it up until late. And you were like.
I already knew what I was going to do.
You were like. And I didn't even realize you were doing fucking paper. It looked like you clapped like this. So. Do we keep that around?
I don't think so.
Okay. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Scissors.
Paper.
Rock, paper, scissors.
Fucking A.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot, scissor.
Rock.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot, rock.
Paper. I you win.
Okay. This is a murder episode, by the way. Okay. So we are talking about...
murder.
The Papon sisters. Papon sisters.
I think it's the... I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah.
You got it.
Spelled Papin.
Yeah.
Papon sisters. Christine and Leah Papon lived in villages around Le Mans in western France. They were 7 years apart and bonded closely together due maybe in part to familial trauma. They had an older sister named Amelia who became a nun in a monastery after their father raped her. Mm. I have a little bit of background on the father. Her father was known for his violence, both physical and sexual, even directing that towards his younger daughters at times. The relationship between him and Clemence, his wife, was becoming progressively more volatile. Nope, his name is Gustav. There's no time. You're not going to know where to cut that in. It was becoming more volatile. There were reports that she showed no affection for her children or her husband, and she was unstable. Gustav, the father, turned to alcohol. When Amelia was 9 or 10, Clemence sent her to the Bon Pasteur Catholic orphanage. And that's where they then started to hear reports that she had been raped by her father. She very, later on, then became a nun in a monastery. So, Clemence then gave birth to two other children, both of which she and her husband sent away pretty early on in life. I think due to both their volatile relationship and the fact that she didn't care for them. So, Christine was born in 1905 and was the middle child. She was given to her father's sister, who was happy to have her. Christine remained with her aunt for 7 years, after which she entered a Catholic orphanage. She wanted to join the convent, but her mother wouldn't allow her to, and then later on, after she left the orphanage, I'm assuming, placed her in employment. Her personality was stronger and more open than her younger sister Leah's. She was reported to be insolent at her job sometimes, or difficult, but she was a hard worker and a good cook. Leah was more shy. Born in 1911, she was the youngest child. She had a slightly lower intelligence than her older sister, and she was introverted, quiet, and obedient. From infancy, Leah grew up with her mother's brother until he died. Until he died. And then she went into a religious orphanage until she was 15. The girls soon became inseparable. They were always together, but not speaking to each other, which gave people the impression that they had telepathy. And that they were just... Mm-hmm. I know, specifically, like, when you're super close with your sister and you're at a young age, you do not need to talk. You don't. Yeah. They know. They know what you're gonna say. You just stare at them with a certain look, and then they know. They started getting work as maids. Obviously, Christine had already been working as a maid. But they both start working as maids, always in the same house. They are a package deal. Until 1926, when they were hired by René Lancelin to be live-in servants. His household was a mansion occupied by he and his wife and their adult daughter, Genevieve.
Genevieve.
During their 7-year stay, they worked 14-hour days with a half day off per week, which was pretty usual for, like, a live-in servant at the time. Mm-hmm. They rarely left the house, never for social obligations, and spent their time, their free time, together. As maids, they did their work silently and diligently, particularly being praised for their cooking and needlework. In 1933, when Christine was 27 and Leah was 21, on February 2nd, Mrs. Launcelin and her daughter come home at 5:30 p.m. to the house being dark. For the second time that week, the malfunctioning iron blew the electrical fuse while Christine was ironing. The iron had been out for repair, having just returned that day, and the repairman cited no issues. When Christine explained what happened to the strict madam. Why can't I remember how to say this word? Monsieur and madam. Her employer was livid.
They mad.
This was not the first time that she was angry with her, and it made Christine snap. Christine lunged at Genevieve, going for the eyes.
Ew.
Leah, entering the brawl, grabbed Mrs. Lancelin, attempting to gouge her eyes out as well as Christine ordered. Meanwhile, Christine ran downstairs, retrieving a kitchen knife and a hammer. Coming back up, she and her sister bludgeoned and sliced the Lancelins. One of them even having their head bashed in by a nearby pewter pitcher. So at approximately 6:30 to 7 p.m., Mr. Lancelin and his son-in-law arrive at home, when his wife fails to meet him for a standing dinner date at a friend's house. The door was bolted from the inside and the men were unable to enter, though they knew someone was home because they could see a faint glow coming from the upper level. The house was still dark, obviously. They were suspicious, so they went to the police. The police were able to gain entry and they climbed the stairs to the scene of the crime. Most of the injuries were on the faces and heads of the victims, but the daughter's legs and buttocks revealed deep knife lacerations. Both women were extremely unrecognizable. Their faces were completely destroyed. Teeth were scattered around the room. And one of Genevieve's eyes laid on a stair.
Gross.
They later found her other eye under her body. Within the folds of Madame's neck scarf,
Neck flaps.
On her neck scarf were both of her eyes. Madame Lancelin was lying on her back with her legs apart and only one shoe on. Genevieve's body was facing down. Next to her right hip lay a bloody kitchen knife with a dark handle. Blood covered the entire room. It looked like a blood literal bath. Oof. There was blood everywhere. And it also splattered the walls above the bodies. So, after discovering the bodies, they searched the rest of the house. They were worried that the killer was still there and that he'd done the same thing to the sisters. When investigators got to the level where the maid's room was, the door was locked. They got a locksmith on the scene who unlocked the door, and when they opened the door, they found the girls in bed together with their robes on. Some sources say that they were nude. This is from a history website, though, so I feel like this one is correct. Next to the bed on the chair was the bloody hammer. It had hair on it still.
Ugh.
Police asked them what happened, and they immediately confessed.
They were like, I'm not built for this.
It was me. So just initially, in this was revealed in a book by Frederic Chauvin, The Fearful Crimes of the Sisters Pepin. The investigators found the victims with their skirts up and their underwear pulled down. But at the time, in the Franciscans in the 20s, it was improper to take photos with genitalia exposed, so they pulled down the skirts to cover their privates. To cover their genitals. I don't like the word privates. Mm. Grosses me out. So they arrest the sisters, take him into custody. They both confessed. Upon separating them, Christine starts to have, like, bouts of anger, fits, like, depression. She's just, like, freaking out about not being with her sister. When they eventually allowed a meeting between them, she reportedly behaved in a way that implied a sexual relationship between the two. Mm. So they then got three different doctors to do psychological evaluations on the sisters to determine their sanity. Christine was indifferent, and she had no attachments to anything except for Talia. The doctors said that her... All the doctors were, they were like, because the papers took off with it being like, oh my god, an incestuous homosexual relationship. And they all, the doctors that actually analyzed them said that her affection was of family devotion, and they didn't detect any sexual context at all. So Leah looked up to Christine as a big sister or mother figure. Neither of them had any mental disorders. They were deemed completely sane, and they said that the closeness of the girls is what caused them to act out, making them both responsible. It only took them 40 minutes to deliberate, and they found Christine and Leah guilty. Leah only served a 10... Well, she was only given a 10-year prison sentence of hard labor. And Christine initially got the death penalty, but then that was changed to life in prison. At the trial, a fourth doctor testified. Everyone had theories. The doctor said that the girls could not be normal. He said that the relationship between Christine and Leah was a complete merger of personalities, and that Leah had lost her identity to the dominant personality of Christine. In essence, there was no Christine or Leah. The killer was a joint personality of the two, a third identity. Elizabeth Carey Mahone said the two sisters seemed to suffer from what is called shared paranoia disorder. This condition tends to occur in small groups or pairs who become isolated from the world. They often lead an intense inward-looking existence with a paranoid view of the outside world.
Like a mini cult.
Yes.
Like a twofer cult.
Exactly, yes. they seem to be a perfect example of this. Usually there's one more dominant person in it.
The cult leader.
And then, of course, there was a theory that there was incest, which then took over the narrative. They said that she caught them, Miss Lancelin caught them, and that's why they killed her. So, here's the thing. They separated them, obviously. Christine didn't do well. She had bouts of madness. She became severely depressed. She wouldn't eat.
That was the one with the more dominant personality, right?
Yes. She tried to gouge her eyes out. And then when they, like, questioned her about it, she was like, this is exactly how I felt on the night of the murder, trying to imply that she might have been, like, not sane. They ended up transferring her to a mental institution when she wouldn't eat, but she continued to starve herself until she died in May 1937. Leah had exemplary behavior and served 8 years of her 10-year sentence, was let out on good behavior. And then in 1941, she was released. She went to live back with her mother, Clémence, in France under a different name, getting a job in housekeeping. Some people think she died in 1982, but in 2000, while filming In Search of the Pepin Sisters, Claude Ventura claimed to have found her in a hospice, and she was mute from a stroke that she'd had. And then she died in 2001, so one year after the film.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that it was so close. Like, I didn't know. For some reason, I thought it was in, like, the 1800s.
Nope.
I know about the case. I just didn't know that it was so close. So,
and this was a sensationalized case too, because it was scandalous, because everyone was about why the murders were personal and savage. A lot of people tried to say, because there were the people who were like making it crazy because they were so close, and then there were some people who were making it a big deal because, how could you live there for 6 years with no incident? There were some people who were upset because they were like, this is clearly an incestuous relationship. They were too close. And then there were people who saw them as heroes of the class struggle. They said that what they fought was class division, poor work conditions, and prejudices. That's why they killed them.
I feel like I can kind of see a mixture of all of those.
Yeah. There were a ton of movies and documentaries made. For movies and documentaries, there was Murderous Maids, The Horrible Crime of the Pepin Sisters, The Maids, which was a play by Jean Genet.
Ramsay.
You fuck. So for literature, they wrote The Pepin Sisters, which was Oxford Studies in Modern European Culture, The Murder in Le Mans, an essay in Paris Was Yesterday, a book by Janet Flanner, and then The Crime of the Pepin Sisters, which was an essay by Neil Patton. There was almost like a perverse obsession in filmmakers about this.
There were two sisters that may or may not have had a sexual relationship.
It was two women who did the killing. The killing was so brutal. Mm-hmm. The fact that there was, like, a definite class difference between them. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to read you some of the few. Okay, so Jean-Pierre Denis was the director of Murderous Maids, who described it as a story that touches upon our deepest, darkest impulses.
I don't want to gouge anybody's eyes out.
Yes. These two women were presented as monsters in the press of the day. Well, I wanted to follow the path from monsters back to human beings. In the play, The Maids has fractured parodies. It's very illustrious. Surrealists embraced the Pepin sisters and the movement assaulted on the bourgeois complacency. Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre admired them as revolutionaries. They said that Christine's ravings in prison kind of made it a doubt on her sanity. Jacques Lacan used their case to develop his theories on psychosis and human identity. Oh, Claude Chabrol in La Cérémonie, which was in 1995, that was a film about a upper middle class family which was murdered by their illiterate housemaid and her accomplice, a giddy postal clerk. The sisters were just one element inspiring his gleeful portrait of an anarchic feminine criminality. A lot of people say that this somehow like goes against the patriarchy. Christine Pepin, like Jean Genet, was among those whose destiny it is to be abandoned, said Mr. Denis. Their mothers gave them up, Christine at 28 days and Genet at 7 months. He said he turned to writing to free himself, while Christine Pepin had only her work as a domestic to console her. There are some people who said Christine felt she had no place in society. She created herself the character of the perfect maid, and then one day she was told you're an imposter, so she took the place of a murderess instead. It's all very much like this, just over and over and over again. Everyone has their own little hot take on it. Everyone wants to make it beautiful. Oh, this one was a good one, actually. So, In Search of the Pepin Sisters, which is a documentary by Claude Ventura, it explores the legal ambiguities in the case and follows the sisters' traces. The few Le Mans residents who knew them as maids said that they had attention to detail of dress and their air of haughtiness. They said, at the time, there were just three kinds of maids. Slutty maids, maids who stole, and maids who drank.
What the fuck? I've never heard of that last one.
Yes. They said, this is from an aging son of a family that once employed the sisters. Oh my God. He said, well, Christine was a new type, the insolent maid. So, yeah, it's just, they also are some of the best known celebrities in the region. Those two. It happened 80 years ago. So, not that long ago. But yeah, it was a fucking cultural reset, if you will. Not necessarily a good one.
Yeah.
But it happened. So, and that's my story.
That's the Pepin sisters?
That's the Pepin sisters. Let me tell you my sources. So I used Insider, The New York Times, The Vintage News, and Historic Mysteries. And they were all very good.
Okay.
Yes.
That was very good.
Oh, wait. Did I say the film one? That was the one that I just said. Oh, yeah. That was the New York Times. They just covered the film part of it. And that's it.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm ready for your story, though. Wow, my story was a lot longer than I thought it was.
That was good. Okay. So let's just jump right in, as I always say, every week. Mm-hmm. Our story starts on the afternoon of... On the afternoon of May 18th, 1993, in an outside courtyard of an apartment complex in Inglewood, Colorado, 5-year-old Allie Bareilles was playing with her 3-year-old brother, Sam. The babysitter went inside for a few minutes, and when she returned, Allie was missing from the yard. Police were called to the scene and immediately conducted a door-to-door search for Allie, which basically turned up nothing. Mm-hmm. This search dragged on for 4 days and turned up little to no clues. So they decided to bring in the big guns. After 4 days, they brought in a bloodhound named Yogi and his handler, Jerry Nicholas.
You see the big guns?
He is the big guns.
Yogi.
For those of you who don't know, bloodhounds are used to follow the individual scent of a fugitive or lost person, taking the scent from a scent article, something the individual in question is known to have touched, which could be an item of clothing, a car seat, an identified footprint, etc. There are many accounts of bloodhounds successfully following trails many hours and even several days old. Yogi at the time also happens to be the best in his field.
Ooh, Yogi!
Like a good boy.
Yeah, what a good boy.
Yogi took Allie's scent from clothes she had recently worn and got straight to work. He first went up the stairs and zeroed in on a specific apartment, and this was the one that she lived in. This was good because it meant that he was on the right track. Mm-hmm. Allie's grandfather, Richard Bareilles, commented, "I wanted to have hope that this bloodhound would be able to find our granddaughter. I was watching the dog work, and I felt there was a sort of comfort that I felt, because I felt, now they're going to find her. Now they're going to find her, and they're going to find her alive." Yogi led Jerry out of the apartment complex and down the street, heading south. News reporters were following close behind, but this didn't stop Yogi or distract him from doing his doggy duties. I'm funny. Anyway, Jerry, the canine officer, said he didn't care. He was oblivious to everything other than what he was doing because he's happy doing that. A bloodhound is by instinct a tracker. By nature, it's something that they are bred to do and they live to do. Their sense of smell is just incredible. The loose skin around their face acts as a place for the scent to be attracted to. The skin folds. The gels and slobbers, the moisture that the dog is emitting will actually help enhance the scent from his face. Around his face, excuse me.
Please never say any of those words again.
It's putting the moisture in the air and those long, dangling, floppy ears, it kind of stirs it up in front of him. A scent trail, both human or animal, comes from thousands of dead skin cells that we constantly are shedding. Jerry had explained that unless those cells are swept away by severe weather, the scent could remain for up to a month. Yogi followed Allie's scent, and Jerry recognized that Yogi was following a certain path. If a person is walking on foot, the scents are a little bit stronger, and they're going to stay by the sidewalk. But he is working wide between the streets, in between the front of businesses, and he's still picking up the fringes. Seeing him do that before, in my mind, he was working on a car. So the motions that he was making followed that of a car, because there wasn't just one path. It was mm-hmm. very broad. Fun fact, we leave scent trails even more from moving cars. Didn't know that. The skin cells shoot through the car's vent and exhaust system and are basically deposited on the side of the road.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, so we are everywhere. Bloodhounds can pick up these scents even being able to find someone who is sealed up in a trunk. So they did a test and they sealed somebody up in a trunk and they were still even able to find them.
That's fucking sick. I want a bloodhound.
Yogi tracks south for several miles, covering almost 40 city blocks. At the entrance to a freeway, he headed straight up the westbound ramp, and the search party drove west to the next exit. So they had him on it, because obviously they don't want him to get hit by a car. They would drive to each exit, let him get out, and kind of sniff around. So the search party drove west to the next exit, he went past it, and continued to pick up the scent down the freeway. The search party did this several times to each exit,
But to save time, the police decided to skip the fourth exit and move on to the fifth one. When they got to it, Yogi lost the scent, and he made it known that they had overshot. So they backtracked 1/2 mile to the fourth exit, and he picked up the scent and led them off the freeway. He headed in the direction of a wooded area called Deer Creek Canyon. After 7 hours, Jerry saw Yogi losing power, and he was exhausted and overheated, but being a bloodhound, he wasn't trying to just abandon the scent, and they ignored his exhaustion. Bloodhounds tend to ignore their exhaustion. They'll just keep going. They're very focused once they have something. So Jerry called the search that day. The next morning, Yogi was sidelined, and volunteers continued the search in Deer Creek Canyon. An hour later, and 14 miles away from Allie's home, her body was discovered. She had been stuffed into a green khaki duffel bag and tossed off a 20-foot embankment. She was found less than 2 miles from the point Yogi was made to stop, so it's understandable why he was so reluctant to stop. Mm-hmm. So, when the autopsy came back inconclusive, it was said that she had suffered from severe asthma, and it's possible that that contributed to her death. A second bloodhound was brought into the investigation, and they started at where Allie's body had been found. This second bloodhound led them back to the Golden Nugget Apartments, where she lived, and Allie's 3-year-old brother Sam told investigators that the old man had taken her and walked them to the door of the unit in the building labeled 106A and pointed at it. So for a 3-year-old, he's pretty, like, on point.
Why didn't they ask him 5 days before that?
I don't know when they asked him exactly. There wasn't a lot of information about the brother's part in it. Mm-hmm. They were just like, he was 3, they were eating pizza, he showed them where he lived. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know if they did it from the beginning. But we maybe get a little bit more into it, if it might answer your question. They learned that a man named Nicholas Raymond Stouffer had just moved into that apartment just weeks earlier, and they were unable to speak with him as the day her body was found, he was already on his way to California. Later, they would find out that he was probably in the apartment when they first knocked on the door, and the hours after Allie vanished, but never opened it. So when they did that door-to-door sweep... Mm-hmm. They learned that he had skipped work the day Allie vanished and that friends had seen a green duffel bag in his apartment. Uh-huh. He had also borrowed a car 2 days later, and they believe that that is the car he used to dump her body in Deer Creek Canyon. Fortunately, they were able to find and question him later on in California and were able to extradite him to Colorado on an outstanding DUI ticket. They took his hair and DNA and brought it to the district attorney at the time in Arapahoe County. Bob Gallagher, who was the district attorney at the time, decided there wasn't enough to file charges. So it kind of just stood in limbo for a while. Over the years, detectives would go back in and file into the files over and over again, trying to comb through it and find any new angles that they may have missed and pursue. So in January of 2011, an Englewood detective named Bobby Garrett took another look, and she found red flag upon red flag when it came to Nick Stouffer. She sent some of Allie's clothing and the duffel bag to the CBI for tests using more advanced and new developed techniques to capture some genetic samples.
What year was this again?
This was originally it was in 1993 that the case happened.
Oh.
But this new investigation wasn't until 2011.
Oh, okay.
So she sent some of the samples to the CBI for testing, and when the results came back on February 8th, 2011... one DNA profile was collected from Allie's underwear, and a second partial profile found on the waistband of the panties came back. The results were announced to the public on September 13th that the match was to Nick Stouffer. Unfortunately, by the time this breakthrough came, he had been dead for 10 years.
Oh.
Yeah. In October 2001, Nick Stouffer was found dead inside his Phoenix apartment of a drug overdose. The police were called for a welfare check, and his family had not... because his family had not heard from him in some time. And when he was discovered, he had been dead already for 2 days. At a news conference, the Englewood Police Chief John Collins said, "We had to wait 18 years for the forensic science to catch up with the evidence that we had on hand. Our case will be closed knowing that Nicholas Stouffer was the individual that caused the disappearance and death of Allie Bareilles." And that's where that ends.
Did they give a motive at all?
Nope. There was a lot of, like, weird... sideline information about it. Like, one person was like, oh, like, friends would be like, oh, he one time mentioned that he wonders what it's like to kidnap a little girl. But it's like, who mentions that?
Yeah, is, like, that real?
They were like, oh, in a drug and stupor he said that, and it's like, I only saw that in one place, so Okay. Who knows if it was like an underlining thing that he had always been feeling, or it was just like a spare the moment kind of thing. But Allie's family has set up a foundation for bloodhounds so that they can be available to search for missing people.
Aww.
Yeah, so that was really nice. And that's the story of Allie Bareilles. I got my information from unsolved.com, unsolvedmysteries.fandom.com, screenrant.com, Unsolved Mysteries Reddit, hosted by Queen of Anavia. A-N-A-V-I-A. Queen of Anavia? And denverpost.com. And that's my story. And I'm sticking to it.
It's a good story.
Thanks. I just thought it was really cool, the bloodhound thing.
Yeah, the bloodhound thing is definitely cool. That was
top notch.
And they solved it. It's always good to see a cold case get closed.
For sure. After 18 years, definitely.
It's unfortunate when it gets solved after the person gets killed and then it's like, or dies and it's like, oh, they didn't.
Yeah, so I think that was really cool. I mean, it wasn't really cool, but...
It's cool how he died.
It's cool how he died. I mean, fuck that guy. But yeah, there wasn't very much on even the case itself. A lot of it was repeated information, but it was on Unsolved. At the time, it was Unsolved. So, take somebody else. I just think it's ridiculous that it took them so fucking... but again, the science wasn't there at the time.
Yeah.
1993, yeah. I'm surprised they didn't throw the shit out, you know? So, good on them for keeping their files correct.
Thanks for listening to us, guys. Thanks for telling your friends. We noticed you're doing that, and we really appreciate it.
You're great.
Continue to do so. If you would like to see adjoining photos and information, you can find that on our Instagram and Twitter at
Gumshoe Weekly,
and our Facebook at
Gumshoe Pod.
And if you wanted to email us anything at all, just anything your heart desires, you can do that at
gumshoeweekly@gmail.com.
And that's all, folks. Porky Pig is gonna sue me.